The best of our knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York will celebrate its bicentennial commencement, and AI will have a big hand in the ceremony. And we'll speak with a graduating high school senior who's been honored as a 2024 Champion for Change at the Center for Native American Youth. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. On Saturday, May 18th, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York will celebrate its bicentennial commencement. Scheduled to speak at the event are NASA astronaut and 1997 RPI grad Reid Wiseman and Emily Warren Roebling, or at least an AI-generated representation of the woman who saw through the completion of the Brooklyn Bridge in 1883. Roebling was the wife of Brooklyn Bridge chief engineer Washington Roebling, who graduated RPI in 1857. She assumed the role of chief project manager of the construction of one of New York City's most famous landmarks as her husband's health declined. To bring Emily Roebling into the 21st century, RPI researchers used artificial intelligence to analyze her writings and create scripted dialogue based on her use of language. Roebling's AI-generated words will be given a voice by actress Liz Wiseman, who portrayed Roebling in the HBO series The Gilded Age, which was partially filmed in Troy. To learn more about the project and Roebling's AI-assisted commencement appearance, I spoke with the director of RPI's Future of Computing Institute, Dr. Jim Hendler.
We actually spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to do this, and we found there's a fair amount of biographical information, but we wanted to capture her style, her personality. And, you know, we have some archives at RPI that have a lot of information about her. Jennifer went down to Rutgers, got things. So we have original letters she wrote, things like that. So we took a lot of that stuff and did what's called prompt engineering and fine tuning, which are the things you do to an AI.
That's like you give it documents, you give it a piece of text so the computer can learn how to write in that style.
Right. So what we would do is we would give it a lot of samples, both facts about her, things she had written, excerpts from personal letters, which we had access to, excerpts from professional statements, articles she had written, etc. And then the script was written between her, you know, what the conversation would be between her and the astronaut was more or less, we came up with the questions in advance, and then we said, okay, how would she answer them? And for some of them, we had to change the questions a little. So it was a really exciting project where we added artificial intelligence, human intuition and knowledge, and archival information, because it really wouldn't have worked if we didn't have the information about what she sounded like, what she acted like, how she was. And we've documented as we went along some of this. So probably in the fall, we'll give a open seminar on how we did it and, you know, sort of what things look like. We used the professional version of ChatGPT as our base. And, you know, we were very careful to make sure that we've stated everywhere we can that, you know, this was not her words. These are words as if she were speaking as best we can. We want to emphasize we're not trying to bring, you know, somebody back from the past. You know, we're not revitalizing a dead person. What we're really doing is trying to capture the essence of her writing and her personality in answering these questions and in addressing our students.
So the actress that will be portraying Emily Roebling, Liz Wiseman, was on the Gilded Age program on
yes.
HBO, and that series was filmed in RPI's backyard in Troy, New York.
Yes, parts of it.
So did you approach Liz, and was she on board? Had she read AI script maybe even before, because AI is becoming more prevalent, especially in writing situations?
So, she was approached, the leadership approached her about doing it. She checked with HBO, because obviously once you've portrayed a character, you have to be careful. They were happy to let us do it. She wanted the script in time, so I don't think she cared much about where the words came from. She wanted to, you know, learn the words. She has her own, you know, work she did on trying to learn a little bit about Emily and what she sounded like, but she candidly admitted that, you know, she really hadn't studied her and that she would leave it up to us to do the, you know, getting the words in the right style, and she would work on, you know, getting into the kind of voice and feel of the times.
Now, is it also possible now that you'll have a recording of Liz reading Emily Roebling's AI computated dialogue and words, then that audio itself can be used by a ChatGPT application or similar application to then reproduce even more dialogue by Emily Roebling?
Yeah, you know, this is an interesting issue that a lot of us at AI grapple with, which is, so what you use to train these large language models has primarily been stuff found on the web, documents. Well, now more and more of those documents are being written either by a human with AI, some of them AI generated, some of them pattern generated. So there are more and more tools for the stuff out there to be generated by AI. And the question is, what happens when AI is just reading stuff that other AIs wrote? And where does creativity go? Where does sort of the human nature of this stuff happen? So frankly, most of us believe, like, so for example, this thing we did would not have worked if it was just AI, just archives, or just us trying to do it ourselves. So we could read the archives and say, you know, here's an interesting thing Emily said, but how do I answer a different question in that style? You know, training ChatGPT not to use terminology that is more modern. So one of the things Emily did talk a lot about was the role of women. But remember, this is pre-feminist. This is 1880s, 1890. And so it was written very carefully. And you know, when you've just first asked ChatGPT, it used very modern descriptions of feminism and STEM and things like that. After we had trained it, it talked about, you know, women and engineering, how, you know, the training that she did had to be somewhat secondhand because she couldn't attend RPI, so she was learning with her husband, that kind of thing.
How long does it take to train an AI to nail down the language of someone who's been dead for 120 years?
You know, a lot of it depends on how much information you can get, where you can get it. We've been working on this for a little more than a month. And remember, we're not trying to do major speeches or really, you know, again, capture some. You can't talk to it. You can't, like, have a discussion with it. We have sort of prepared. We worked hard to get good answers to specific questions. There are times where we had to actually insert by hand. So we find something in this letter and say, you know, that phrase really should go over in this answer. And, you know, we're not asking ChatGPT to do that. We're just doing it. So it was really a combination. More time would make it better, but we were able to do it pretty quickly. And if it had been, you know, if it had been all we were doing, because of course, all three of us had our regular jobs to do at the same time, you know, I think in a few days we could have gotten the first draft done. We then iterated it with people who knew the family, with people who knew some of the history, did it again. So, you know, we did it in a very iterative nature, but it's taken us about 4 weeks to get to where people are very happy with. People who know the family believe it captures correctly their history. People who've heard speeches from that time on old records and things say it's capturing thing. And our archivist who's really studied Emily's letters, and we just today found a new one. So that was exciting. You know, we're really able to figure out what inputs we needed to do the training that would get it to, you know, how would we do an astronaut between a dialogue between somebody who did something in the late 1800s and an astronaut who's working on a moon mission for the future. And it was a lot of fun.
Dr. Jim Hendler is the director of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute's Future of Computing Institute. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. making your mark as an artist in an era of modern technology where algorithms and AI spout endless content on social media can be a challenge. As WAMC National Productions intern Florinda Juppé reports, one college is bridging the gap between conventional studio art and ever-evolving technology.
Union, a small liberal arts college in Schenectady, New York, has been educating students for more than two centuries. But the private institution is anything but behind the times. Union's visual arts department offers a program where students can use high-tech tools to find new ways to express themselves. Three courses blend art and tech, and they're not just open to fine arts majors. Courses Digital Fabrication, Physical Computing, and Real and Recorded Time are available to learners from different academic backgrounds, with few prerequisites. Today, inside Union's Visual Arts building, students are discussing sound art compositions they created from a listening exercise part of the Real and Recorded Time course. Juliet Richenthal, a sophomore visual arts student, spent 10 minutes with classmates listening to the ambient sounds in an academic building. After returning to the lab, the group used a computer program called Linux Multimedia Studio to reproduce what they heard electronically. The goal is to condense it into a one-minute composition. Richenthal says the exercise was difficult, but she took inspiration from avant-garde composer John Cage.
It was a bit of a challenge to listen to everyday sounds, but kind of interpret them in a more abstract way. And that really, really resonated with me because I'm a dancer, I did modern dance, and one of my pieces was to John Cage, who really inspired me.
The student groups then played all of their individual sound compositions simultaneously. Another course, Digital Fabrication, is an advanced sculpture course. Here, students use machines to fabricate art. Cole Belmont, director of Union's Makerspace Consortium and digital fabrication instructor, uses a laser cutter to precision cut a sheet of material. The cutter can create complex or irregular shapes that would be difficult to cut or to even draw by hand. Belmont says he wants students to understand the role tech can play in visual arts and to see the computer as a collaborator.
I think that it's important for them to have a full kit of tools, for them to be able to not only work on the kind of analog and the more traditional methods of making art, but also to incorporate some of these more contemporary digital tools like laser cutters and CNC machines.
The CNC, or computer numeric control machine, uses a subtractive process to carve away material like metal to reveal an object. Students also use high-pressure water jet cutters to carve shapes out of half inch of steel.
1, 2, 3.
They're all going in opposite directions. In physical computing, students explore robotic and interactive art, kinetic sculpture, and performance. In a hallway inside the visual arts building, small robots built by students are being presented and tested.
That you learned, right? The weight is too much.
Computer science major Spencer Schaefer's assignment was to present a robot built on a very short timeline. His build resembles a miniature space shuttle.
You're trying to make art that is very much entwined with robotics, which is technology. So you have a lot of motors, you have to do a lot of programming for it in order to make whatever art you design actually move and function. So, I mean, it's very much like one of like the best mixes of technology and art.
Andrea Mullen, a senior studying visual fine arts and biomedical engineering, used to think she wasn't creative enough to study arts until she was introduced to digital arts.
I think one thing I struggled with the traditional art is I never thought I was artistic or creative enough. And then I learned that you can combine art and technology. And I was like, wait, I actually am really creative. I can do this. So like, it's allowed me to realize that I am an artist just in a different way. And I think it's really beautiful too, because it allows more opportunity for people to express themselves.
Visual and digital arts professor Fernando Oriana says the students are learning skills that they will carry into the real world. Oriana says one computer program taught at Union that is especially valuable to students is Adobe After Effects for motion graphics.
Not a lot of people know After Effects, and it's a really valuable commodity in a lot of applications, from marketing to graphic design to just full-blown animations to Hollywood, whatever you can think of. For instance, I have a student that graduated from here a few years ago, and she is now a graphic designer creating motion graphics for multi-screen displays on Times Square.
Oriana says not everyone will go on to become a conventional artist, but he wants them to build the skills that could lead to a number of career paths.
I think as a whole, this department prepares students to be generalists. You know, like they could go into fine art if they'd like, but they also have skills that could be applied in the private sector to make money or to, you know, to start companies, whatever it is.
By keeping an open mind, administrators at unions say artists will be able to keep up with time and technology. For the best of our knowledge, this is Florinda Juppé.
WAMC National Productions intern Florinda Juppé is a 2024 graduate of the University at Albany, where she studied journalism and honors English. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. In his final semester, South Dakota high school senior Wambly Quintana refused to let senioritis set in. Involved in the National Honor Society and Cheyenne River Youth Project's Youth Advisory Council, the Dupree High School grad is a young leader among his Cheyenne River Reservation community. Chosen as a 2024 Champion for Change at the Center for Native American Youth, Quintana had the opportunity to travel to Miami for the International Aspen Ideas Climate Conference. Quintana spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's Jody Cowan about his ideas and life on the reservation.
You have rural states, South Dakota, North Dakota, Nebraska, Wyoming, Montana, and it's sort of similar like that. But the thing that separates us from, you know, those areas when it comes to, you know, rural America is that we have a sort of, when it comes to reservations, you have a more closer community because everyone you know is related to you in one way or another. And one of the main beliefs of our tribe is how we're all related. We're all in that Teospie, Oyate, and which means Oyate is the people, but Teospie is family. And over here, you can really see that everyone's closely connected because when you need help, it's always just a phone call away and you'll get help as fast as, you know, we can. But it gets difficult here because it's sort of a large, you know, large area to encompass. Our population, I believe, it's in the 10,000 and above, but it is a sort of diverse area because we have people living by the Cheyenne River right now, but we don't actually get to control the resources of the Cheyenne River. When you go get groceries and stuff like that, usually you'll have, you know, Native families go out to the nearest city, which could either be Pierce, South Dakota, or Rapid City, South Dakota, to get groceries that they think is more quality than what we have here. Definitely there is a sort of bridging that we need to have when it comes to connecting all our communities, because it's sort of like a long drive visiting the each sectors of our tribe. A large area and a large like displacement when it comes to like schooling and stuff like that. It could be kind of hard for people to, you know, trek up to school sometimes because of the road conditions. They get terrible when it rains or when it's, you know, snows heavy like this. So it's not, you know, uncommon to hear, you know, a lot of canceled days because of weather along with other factors that go into it.
How did you get into the work that you do around sustainable energy, and what inspired you to get into this kind of community action?
So what inspired me was just the teachings of my elders. I was raised by my grandparents. I moved to South Dakota in, I think it was around 2015 or so. I've been living with them ever since. And they kind of just like tried to, you know, instill our Lakota culture into me to try and be a culture bearer. Unfortunately, my grandfather passed away, but my grandma kept the traditions as much as she could. And she always talked about how we're related not only to everyone on the earth, but we're also related to the land, the animals, and everything around us. And that teaching really, you know, it really touched my heart. My grandma, the way she took care of me, it's very, you know, it's very, very close relationship. She loved me. She cherishes me. She nurtures me, and she provides a place for me to live. And, you know, there's many similarities. Our word for grandma is unchi. In Lakota, it's unchi, but our word for earth is unchi maka, which is grandmother earth. And just as my grandma has taken care of me and nourished me without any discrimination, so is the earth. The earth has never discriminated against me. It's provided me a place to grow, to breathe, and to overall flourish in my own life. And just as I want to give back to my grandma, I want to give back to the earth that sort of raised me. And now it's my turn to, you know, pay back the favor and to take care of the earth the way it's taken care of me.
And what are some of the plans that you've helped to put into action within your own community or beyond?
I have been currently researching, you know, sort of better ways to introduce sustainable practices and sustainable energy, and going into like conference like the Aspen Ideas Festival. I have a meeting with our tribal council to sort of introduce the idea of projects that we could actually implement within our tribe within, you know, the next coming years. And I've also just been sort of like networking and getting to have contacts with the Aspen Ideas Festival for Climate. I got to meet a lot of great companies that could work well with my tribe, and, you know, exchanging contact information with them and talking back and forth, it's going to prove to be quite beneficial, because they also see, like, they have that mindset of wanting to give back to the earth. And our people, we're supposed to be the land bearers and the stewards of our land. And if we can implement ideas like this, we can show, you know, other reservations that it's possible to take care of our land while creating a future for our next generation of youth. That's what I've basically been trying to do, is laying down that fundamental groundwork so we can have more ideas like this flourish within our native communities. And it's gonna ramp up in this year. I'm very excited to, you know, sort of get these projects in hand. But for now, one of the big things that I've done is help host a community feed where we introduce sort of like renewable topics on the table. And that was for the community itself. Thankfully, to the Cheyenne River Youth Project, they've been such a great help to me. They've really you know, helped care for me and helped provide these spaces where I could talk about sustainable practices and renewable energy to our community. And when you have the, you know, the people's support upon that, then so will the tribal council and our tribal leaders, because they represent the people. And that's what I've been doing for now. But I plan to go to college. college is coming up very soon. There's only so much I could do as a high school student. But I am doing as much as I can so I could lay down that groundwork.
You were recently named one of five champions for change at the Aspen Institute Center for Native American Youth, and got to travel to Miami for the Aspen Ideas Festival. What was that trip like?
It's pretty great. Flying into Florida, it's kind of a little change, because in South Dakota, you kind of have a very drastically different temperature. When I remember when I was flying, you know, once we started descending into Florida, the humidity got me instantly. And then from there, we got checked in at the Aspen's Climate Convention. When we checked in, we saw that there was a sort of like expo event inside, and it basically introduced a whole bunch of sustainable projects and renewable energy products. One of the things there was one of these containers that was repurposed into sort of like a learning center, but they could also be used to act as like Wi-Fi ports, so whenever a hurricane hits. So it was really interesting to see that. There is also projects showing about like EV chargers with solar panels, so you could have a solar panel with batteries to help charge your EVs. You have other solutions like foldable solar panels and all the all these types of, you know, ingenious inventions and products that could be given to consumers in America. Once they got to the point of where we were speaking, we got to see Deb Holland, such a great person to be around. She is truly a big inspiration to me and to a lot of Native youth when it comes to like Indigenous leaders within America. And we went over the questions. Usually when I get nervous before like talking in front of crowds, what I like to do is remember why I'm there. And when I remember why I'm there, I think about, you know, just like how far I've come from my ancestors all the way down to this point in my life where I'm going to go up to a big stage and talk to so many people. The reason why I'm there is no coincidence. I'm there for a reason. So not only will I be representing myself, but I'll be representing the people of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe and the youth of our Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. And when you represent the youth, that is an honor to be recognized. It's a privilege to be able to represent our youth. And when I think about that, it gets me going. And the nervousness usually turns into excitement, because I get so excited that I actually get to, you know, speak as a young person. And when I get to go up on stage and talk with Deb Holland and my fellow Native youth leader, it was, you know, it was sort of like a bookmark in my life.
Yeah, that's awesome. What can the rest of us do to support your efforts to be better stewards to our environment and our communities?
So definitely just keep yourself educated. One of the big things now these days is to find more fact than opinion. Stay educated on your own. Take everything with a grain of salt. Educate yourself on things. Make sure when you come down to a decision, make sure you're the one that's actually deciding, not other people for you. Look into Native America, which is just all of our tribes and what's going on currently. Definitely, I would say look into the Cheyenne River Youth Project because they're doing such great work on my reservation for Native American youth. There's many ways to get involved with the Youth Project, from donating to volunteering even. They really are about the youth, and that's one of the great ways to help steward our land is to start creating these leaders. I'm very thankful for the Cheyenne River Youth Project for developing me into the leader I am today. When it comes to like supporting actual work itself, definitely look into our tribes' delegations and what's going on currently, even just people listening to our stories, Native youth stories itself, can have a long-lasting effect, in America and in places around the world, because it shows, indigenous ingenuity is quite something to behold upon. And when it comes to supporting Native youth like me, sort of giving back to our land, one of the great ways to do it is just by listening. And when we're heard, we feel empowered. And when we feel empowered, we could get things done.
2024 Champion for Change at the Center for Native American Youth and a member of the graduating class of South Dakota's Dupree High School, Wombly Quintana. He spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's Jody Cowan. If you'd like to tell the Best of Our Knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to the Best of Our Knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1755. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Jody Cowan, the latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.